Let me try and describe little work which we did together with Françoise and together with her experimental group on how cells stick to each other or how you can separate them. The starting point, the classical starting point, is this sort of observation. You start with simple sponges which you can find in the sea. And here's the blue species, and here's the red species, and they're very similar but distinct. And you grind them, and you get a solution with blue and red, so you get a mauve solution. But if you wait for some time, you see segregation building up. And after enough waiting, you return to pure blue, segregated from pure red. So you do perceive recognition and adhesion in systems like this. From a more systematic point of view, this story really started in the 1970s, where some specific molecules were recognized and determined. In this case, it started by adhesion between neurons and systems like this in the chick embryo. And progressively, these NCAMs, as they are called, cellular adhesion molecules, were recognized to be omnipresent and were classified from their sequence. That's the beauty of molecular biology. They don't need all the tools which we think of about structure and so on. Just looking at the sequences, we could put these things into families and find for each family one part which is a root, one part which is in the membrane, one part which protrudes outside, and in this protrusion part, one part which is the recognition center. So they had most of the message by means which are much faster than what we can provide. Another family which became very important was the cadherin family. And a typical example where the cadherins work is this sort of epithelial tissue. In fact, cadherin refers to that epithelium calcium dependent adhesive molecules. And inside your intestine, for instance, you all have this structure with all this very branched, these finger-like objects pointing towards the lumen, collecting the good things. And you have this tissue built up, and this tissue is assembled by a number of adhesive molecules, but one central one in this region is this E cadherin. And this is a homobinding, two identical objects on the two sides come and stick to each other. They are pretty long proteins, typically with 5 globular units on each side, and they meet and stick. I've shown these 5 globular units here, which are very close, in fact, to the proteins from the immune system, the same sort of recognition tricks. This is the sort of object I'm talking about, but of course, being naive physicists, we try to mimic their action on very simplified systems. And this would be typically the sort of situation we think of. We have a vesicle here with a lipid bilayer, a giant vesicle, 10 microns in size. And on the outer surface of this vesicle, we have a few of these active molecules, a very dilute population of them, which corresponds to nature. The cell cannot afford to make too many of these. There are many other functions to be shown on the surface. So you start with this dilute system of what I call binders or stickers. And then you put this in front of another vesicle or equally of a solid surface which carries the receptor sites, which are willing to bind these red binders. The bilayer is very flexible. And as you know, an ideal bilayer is an object with zero surface tension. It has optimized its energy with respect to the area at a fixed number of lipid molecules. So it has ideally zero surface tension, but usually because you have mistreated it in various ways, either by adding some salt inside or by putting it, by squeezing it against surfaces or whatever, it has gained a small surface tension. But this surface tension is extremely small. It is 10 to the 3 times smaller than usual surface tensions. So this is this gamma which I described here, and it's very dependent on how you prepared the animal here, and you have to check for its value when you do the measurement. I may come back on that in a minute. Now the question we ask basically is this one. We expose the solid surface to this vesicle, and we want to see how an adhesion patch grows. Now, of course, with our education, we first dream of ideal conditions, which would be very slow, reversible conditions, where you satisfy some sort of local equilibrium condition all the time. And it's interesting to think about first this sort of thing, and to think about what is the nature of the driving force. Clearly, these red binders tend to come to the adhesion patch because once they are there, they find an attractive energy, which I call U, which can be significantly large. For the cadherins, it's not huge, a few times kT. In the extreme cases, it might be 10 times kT or so, but it's something which is attractive, so they will like to come here. And from a macroscopic point of view, what you would like to define is what is the separation energy, or conversely, the energy which you gain by establishing the contact. This is I call G, and it's an energy per unit area. I think most of us, including me first, if you would have asked me this to me 2 years ago, I would have obviously fell into the trap and said, well, this G is obviously the product of the binding energy U, which we have when we bind here, by the concentration of binders in their two-dimensional state, the number of binders per unit area, which I call gamma. Gamma in for what is inside the patch. But it is not the correct answer in general. The correct answer is related to osmotic pressures. These red animals floating on the surface build up a two-dimensional fluid. And this fluid has a certain osmotic pressure increasing with the local concentration. And the correct answer, which was first shown by Bell and co-workers many years ago, is that this G is the difference of osmotic pressures between inside the patch and just outside. And why is that? Well, I think this little sketch can help you understand. Suppose I have the patch here and the membrane going out here, and suppose, for instance, I tear out a little bit, I'm peeling out the system. Now, the stupid thing to do would be to break the bonds, and that would give me an energy for tear out, which would be this guess here. But the intelligent thing which the system will do is not to break out the bonds, it will be to pile up these mobile binders at a higher concentration here without tearing out any bond. And you see the difference. What limits this process is the fact that they repel each other. It is the two-dimensional osmotic pressure of the system. So from this you get this remarkable Bell property. Now there are many interesting limits. If you go to dilute systems, then you have some sort of perfect gas law for this osmotic pressure. It's kT times concentration. And this would then be much smaller than the stupid estimate, because this binding U is larger than kT. On the other hand, if you go to very dense systems and play with thermodynamic identities on the chemical potential and so on, you can show that for very dense systems, essentially this process doesn't work anymore because they are so packed, they cannot pack anymore. And then you return to this guess here. So you have a large spectrum of possibilities But you have to keep them in mind. From the point of view of experiments, there is, you know, a theorist says we are bringing this vesicle in contact with a flat surface. But how do we do it in practice? It's not so obvious. This large animal, this large vesicle is floating around, and it's very neutral and it's hopping, and it doesn't just obey your command and stick there. So there are actually two main approaches where you can, which allow you to bring it in contact. One thing is very simple, that independently of the biomolecules of the binders, you can have some stupid attraction, say van der Waals attraction, between the lipid molecules in the bilayer and the wall. And that will give you a very small thing, but it may start the process. This little attraction will bind you here and start the thing. That is convenient, but it is not corresponding to the actual biological situation. Because in most biological situations, you want to avoid that cells adhere stupidly for no good reason. You want them to adhere only because of the specific binders. So the biological cells arrange it that they have some forest of water-soluble molecules which protrude out and make something like a brush, a protective brush. This is what they call a glycocalyx, and it's made with proteins and sugars, and it has this achievement. So if you want to be very close to the biological situation, you cannot use that. On the other hand, if you are just a physicist, you use this because it's a very convenient starting point. Gives you in fact, this little patch due to the non-specific thing builds up very fast. This is something which we met in capillarity problems and the dynamics of capillarity. Within seconds, you would build this little van der Waals patch. And after that, for an hour or two, you'd have the interesting processes coming where the molecules gather to build the specific patch. The other approach is to make this object heavy by in a clever additive, which is typically heavy sugar or something like this. You can make it that the internal density inside this sac is maybe 10% higher than the density of water outside. Then you have to be very careful to balance osmotic pressures in the three-dimensional sense. You don't want this thing to osmotically explode, but you can balance that. And then you have what I might call a heavy vesicle. And when this heavy vesicle is put on top of this surface, it will fall gently on it, and hopefully it will build that sort of structure with what I call a cushion of water below. Now, the size, the horizontal size of the cushion is something which is discussed in classical capillarity books, including ours. And it's a very simple thing. If you want to express this in terms of an apparent angle here, this angle is related to the Laplace length, kappa minus 1, and to the size of your vesicle. And the Laplace length of this problem is related to the density difference, delta rho, between inside and outside. And typically, this Laplace length is a few millimeters or so, and this gives you a small cushion area, a few microns or so. The delicate point is, what is the thickness of this cushion? And the first idea, which people had very early, is that there is a strong repulsive force between the undulating membrane and the solid surface. This was first imagined by Wolfgang Helfrich, and the idea is that you have these large fluctuations, but if a wall is present, you suppress some of the fluctuations, you reduce the entropy, you increase the energy, the free energy. And the net result is that you get the repulsion, which is going like distance inverse square. This is the classical argument, but it doesn't work for our systems. Because the Helfrich argument, as it started, holds for a system with strictly zero surface tension, where the membranes can fluctuate widely. But actually, in all our systems, we are dealing with a small but finite surface tension. As I said, maybe 10 minus 3 of normal surface tensions, but it's there. In fact, you can measure it by this thing. This definition of kappa contains the surface tension. So if you measure the size of a cushion, you know what is your surface tension at the moment you're doing the experiment. That's what you want. So there is a cutoff in this. In fact, the fluctuations cannot be as large as Helfrich would want them to be. Now, if you turn the crank of this problem, which lots of people have done, I particularly like a review by Udo Seifert on this, you conclude that the fluctuations are very much reduced and they hold only in a small thickness, which I call H. And this thickness is such that tension times H squared is equal to KT. This gives you things which are... And if I had water, if I had a big tension, this would give me an angstrom. These are the amplitude of fluctuations at the water surface. But here, because the thing is 1,000 times smaller in tension, it gives me significant thickness, which can be a few hundred angstroms, or something like this. And this is really what the cushion thickness will be. Now, this is again a theorist talking, and if we talk to our experimental friends, we find that life is much more complicated, because this heavy thing falls, but it doesn't obviously make this nice symmetric cushion, which I've sketched here. It usually hits at one point and then spreads, and very often it begins to do interesting things before having prepared its cushion properly, if I may say. So there are many complications in detail which I will ignore here, which I call problems of transient states. Now, let me go to the crux of the matter, which is, let me assume that I have established some region of interaction. What happens? And for a moment I will operate with the first preparation method. I will assume that there was a little nucleus of sticking due to van der Waals forces, and we start from that. What happens? Well, the stickers, as I said, do concentrate inside this region here, or here. And if I would plot the concentration of stickers versus some horizontal distance r this way, I would have a high concentration, nearly flat, inside, and a very small concentration at infinity. This is what my system had as its original storage of available molecules. And I must have some depletion here, because I want to attract them. So there must be a gradient this way, so that they fall in. This is what it looks like. And in most practical cases, you have a rather simple case, because the size of the patch will turn out to be much smaller than the characteristic diffusion length, which means that diffusion is fast inside, and this is essentially flat. Now, knowing this, you can solve your, not solve, I mean, you can avoid solving the two-dimensional diffusion problem in a simple way. This is the cheap, a poor man's approach to this. I'm counting how many binders have entered into the patch. And this is something like the internal concentration times the area, corrected for what I had at the start, which is a very small correction. And what is this? Well, this is what I have reaped in this diffusion region. And remember, this is a very small thing. So I have actually a large circle of radius square root of dt, the area of this circle is dt, it contains a concentration gamma naught. This is the number of animals which I have reaped in. Now, of course, I'm cheating in this because this is a 2D problem and there are logarithmic complications in this which are hidden in this k, but which are of no interest at our present level of thought. So this is the sort of thing you have. And you can drop this and you have a very simple relation between size of the patch, internal concentration, and time. Now, on the other hand, what you have to do, this is the transport part of the problem, but there is a hydrodynamic part of the problem. You have to satisfy some force balance at this point. In fact, you see, this thing is taking place over hours or so. So locally, it is reasonable in this case to assume that you have a local equilibrium of forces in the sense which Thomas Young had for capillarity. And this means that you have, let me use this pointer here, although I have a long arm, it's better. You have a surface tension which is pulling this way here. You have another surface tension here, and you have the osmotic pressure. Remember, this was the other force coming in. The osmotic pressure inside, which is pushing this way. And when you balance these things, you get a form of Young's equation, which is that the larger the osmotic pressure tending to pull out, the larger the equilibrium angle here. And this is the sort of relation you're dealing with. It's helpful to take this simple example to make these things concrete. This pressure is proportional to the inner concentration, which we have here. And then, what do we have? Well, R itself is proportional to the angle. So here we have a theta squared factor. We have another theta squared factor coming from this. And the net result is that theta 4 is proportional to time. So you see this combination of transport plus Young's equilibrium equation gives you a very novel type of growth, let us say, which contains the two things. Now, this is not something which we can show clearly on an experiment now, but because there are many other factors which I will describe now. But this, I think, will remain as a reference case. It's a simple limiting case which one can keep in mind. There's another case which is of interest, and this is when you're not at all in a perfect gas limit. If you think of standard Langmuir monolayers, you are very rarely in the perfect gas limit. You're usually in more dense systems where you have all sorts of phase transitions and so on. Well, suppose there is a phase transition. For instance, our fluid of binders has a transition from a gas to a liquid of binders in 2D. And this would mean that if I plot pressure versus concentration, there is a plateau here, constant pressure. And this would lead to a very interesting regime, because if I'm sitting on this plateau, this angle is constant. The shape here has a constant angle, but the concentration is increasing all the time. The system is still pumping, reaping animals from here, and this thing is increasing with time. So you see, you can have very different regimes of this sort, and it will be interesting to see them progressively. I won't insist on that. I will just mention briefly to you what happens in the other preparation method, where we start from a cushion and for some reason we nucleated contact here. We have thought about the ideal nucleation, what you needed as energies to build this little finger downwards, but I don't think it's very relevant. I mean, ideal nucleation is a very rare thing in nature. most cases, what you do is you nucleate on some defect or some dust particle which was hanging there, or purposely you can put a defect to catalyze the starting point. So let's assume you started from this, and then what you do is that you squeeze out this water. This is what typically we call a de-wetting process in capillarity. And then your contact radius increases. Now, from precisely 10 years of studies on de-wetting, we know that the velocity at which this point moves is related to the equilibrium Young angle to the cubed times surface tension divided by viscosity. Now, for most of you, this cube factor will appear as something very unpredictable. I can try and give you a feeling for it. In this factor, we have a theta squared, or 1 minus cosine theta, which is related to the Young forces. The driving force is gamma 1 minus cosine theta. And there's a third factor, theta, which is related to the dynamics. If I have a very small theta, this means that the flows in the wedges are very slow because they have to take place with huge gradients. And this third theta comes from this dynamic feature. So this thing, which is omnipresent in capillarity, is a combination of Young's forces and friction. And if you accept that, you have this relation. On the other hand, you still have the Young law relating the equilibrium angle to the osmotic pressure. And you still have the transport law, which says that you reap all the molecules which are in this. And if you combine all this, you come up with a very unusual law, with this 5/8 power for R, which may have been seen in some of the experiments which we have with Pierre-Henri Puech at home, but we still have to wait to be quite safe about that.
How can it possibly be different after the nucleation has made a patch? Then the two, method one and method two.
I'll tell you. No, the difference is that here I'm still facing a flat structure, while in the other case, I was facing a spherical object. And that is the difference. Here I'm de-wetting a film. So capillarity is different, let's say. That's the source of the difference. Really. Now, of course, if I would go to very long times where I extend this further than the size of my cushion, then I would return to the other regime. Now, let me.
So eventually, this power law has to go
to the other one, if it's visible. I mean, there are many complications because the cushion is not that ideal and so on. Now, precisely, let me go to a little bit of discussion, what I call complications from nature. One thing is this thing that usually, if you have a heavy object, for instance, falling, it will fall in this way. It will have what is called a dimple. Some water will be trapped in here, and there will be a circular annulus of good contact. And this has been seen for 20 years. It's a very classical feature of contact, but it's a big nuisance. Ultimately, usually, if you wait, this dimple will fall out, and you will go to the, hopefully, equilibrium state. But very often, this doesn't happen gently. It could happen gently just by, you know, squeezing out some water from these thin things, but that is very slow, and very often you find instabilities. You find that if you look from the top, you have a circle of trapping points, and there is a door which opens in this, and the whole thing escapes by this door, and after you get rid of the dimple. So there are long times involved, and very often what you find is that your interesting process, your molecular process, starts before you have reached a good symmetry. So you can still follow it, but it's a bit more painful because you don't have the same quality of the geometry, and to compare that with laws is difficult. And the trick which Francoise has found is precisely to have in the center of this some little object added to force the contact in the center and force the thing to start from the center. That's a very good observation. And another complication, which is fun in some sense, but which is a nuisance too, is an observation by Sackman and others that if you, very often you would think that a nice model system for this would be just to have charged objects, for instance, charged lipids, which would be the mobile sticker, which might be positive and attracted to a negative surface or something like this. But what these people point out is that if you start with a charge density on this side and on this side, which are different, so that when you bring them into contact, there are still some counter ions floating. These counter ions have their osmotic pressure and they don't like to be squeezed. And what the system builds is some sort of collection of blisters. And as you can guess, a collection of blisters like this is a much more complex object to study adhesion. It is interesting. It is a beautiful system, but it's a complication. So for that reason, the charge systems are often a nuisance, or you have to balance them very carefully to get rid of it. Another feature which you do meet in the biological examples, which is that your stickers indeed are quite mobile when they are moving on the outer cell surface, but at the moment they meet their partner, their receptor site, they become essentially immobile, nearly immobile, with very slow diffusion constants. And you might wonder whether this upsets the picture very much. It turns out that it changes numerical constants, but it doesn't change the scaling laws too much. So that's a fortunate case where nature doesn't want to complicate our life too much. Then there is another mess which can happen in some cases. These are very complicated proteins. Remember, 5 globules. And they have to find themselves and bind. And this may often have a very strong barrier. It may take times to establish this contact. And if this time becomes comparable with the time of your experiment, then you are dealing with a completely different ballpark. Because the stickers, they can float in the adhesion patch without benefiting from the attraction. They have not bound yet. And this creates a very different dynamics and gives completely different laws. I just put serious changes here without more detail. But it can be a big complication. Another aspect which is important for us, because the people, in fact, the people who first found the cadherins are working at our place, and they have measurements of the binding by pulling out. And this pull-out was the subject of many discussions between us. I will try to summarize it simply. Typically what you have is this. You have your cell or your vesicle, which is sucked in by a small pipette with a small radius RP here, and a certain sucking in pressure, which is related to surface tension and to radius by Mr. Laplace. And in fact, your choice of this aspiration pressure is what defines the actual surface tension of the system. You're monitoring the tension through this. But this is not the only thing. Dependently from that, you can also pull materially on the pipette with a certain force F. And the question is to see when will this break out, and it can break out, in fact, in two ways. Either this finger may drop out of the pipette if the aspiration pressure is too small, or this adhesion patch may disappear, may separate or peel out. And let me insist on this latter case because it's an amusing case. This is 19th century capillarity, but it has its own little wicked point. What are the forces on this solid due to the presence of this vesicle? Radius RV, contact angle theta, and radius of contact R. Well, there is one thing, but there is a tension this way, so there is a vertical force, which is 2 pi r times sine theta, and I forgot gamma, the surface tension should be here. That's a very obvious term. But it's not the only term. There is a pressure term, because from Mr. Laplace we know that the pressure inside this curved object is higher than normal by this amount. And so we have a pressure term. Now if we write this in reduced units, also go to small angles and call psi the ratio of this radius to the overall radius, you end up with a reduced force which has a very simple form. It's a parabolic form. Now if I was having a very small reduced force, I go back to the equilibrium angle, to the Young angle, which corresponds to a certain strength of adhesion here. But if I increase my force, I go to this point, maximum force, and then the thing hops. And if I measure this maximum force, I measure theta squared, and theta squared by Young tells me what is the separation energy. So this is an interesting measurement of the separation energy. The practical technique is often different from that and is based more on observations of what is the pressure here at which this process wins against the process where you leave this piece. But this is a technicality. I won't go into the details of this. I think now we begin to understand what these people measure in their actual measurements. Of course, I should have brought photographs. The real thing with the real cell here is often much worse than what I have described. What I have described here is really an ideal membrane which has a well-defined curvature and so on. What they have is systems which have some sort of internal rigidity because of the cytoskeleton. And very often this complicates matters enormously. So we are still far from having something which is clear-cut for a realistic cell. But at least we begin to understand what happens for this case. So much for the reverse process. Just a word now about a conceptual experiment, a Gedanke experiment, I might say, which has been some fun and which is...
On the previous slide...
Let me bring the slide yet.
I may have done it wrong, but I got that the maximum was theta squared over 4.
Could be. Okay. Now, let's see. Oui, oui. Absolutely right. Okay. Oui, oui. But what is nice is that...
It happens at theta over 2. But
it happens at theta over 2. That's why I wrote it this way. Now, Gedanke experiment. This is something which I discussed with Bill Gelbart from this region of the world in Bristol last fall. The problem is a problem which originally was started by George Oster. The idea is the following. You have here some sort of, say, rigid molecule, might be something like a DNA, and this can go through a membrane or some with a pore here, but this pore doesn't allow anything else to go through. It's a narrow pore. And now you allow some molecules, say proteins, to absorb on this side. And clearly when this thing wanders, if the proteins are absorbed, well, this thing cannot wander to the left. So the overall motion of this animal will progressively be to the right. And Oster had a simple counting argument just based on seeing how many proteins in an ideal situation you would get to get an idea about what was the force which was on this. Now, Bill came with the observation that this was probably not sufficient because if there is a strong binding energy, just like in my binder system, you gain a lot of energy by binding. And that encourages you to expose new surface. So it pushes you to the right more strongly. At the time in Bristol, in front of a British Greek temple, I took a bet with Bill on that. Stupidly, I bet that Oster was right. And Hilly Oster is not right. I lost my bet. But then Bill went to very numerical calculations of what happened and indeed of the dynamics, which is quite an interesting dynamics. But on our side, we realized that there was a very simple law hidden behind this, which I will try to show. Here is the Oster prediction. Here is the Gelbert original prediction before he did all the details. And the simple summary is this thing again. It is that the force is the one-dimensional osmotic pressure of this gas of adsorbed animals. And you can show this by playing with thermodynamic identities. But I think it provides a very unifying point of view. And again, in the dilute limit, you go back to Oster, and in a very concentrated limit, you would go to this early Gelbart, I would say, the full Gelbart covering all cases. But it has been an amusing case. So the overall conclusion from this is that osmotic pressures in these systems are a very useful guide. And indeed, for the case, for instance, where you have some which bind, but some which are slow in binding, you realize that those which are slow in binding don't see an osmometer situation. They can move around, they don't participate to the balance. It's only the bound ones which participate. So for reasons of this sort, this osmotic pressure concept is really the guiding idea. And I really felicitate this gentleman Bell, which I had never met, but which did that first. That was a great idea. Okay, I'll stop at this point. Thank you very much for your attention and hope to come back with more experiments in the future.
How long do you have to live before you feel the osmotic pressure?
Wait. There is an intrinsic time which shows up in Gelbart, for instance, which is the time for capture from solution 3D to the rod, in his case. And there is a characteristic length in this when you compare the overall concentration to the concentration of a surface, how far do you have to reap to get this? So this gives you a length, and this, you translate this length into a diffusion time. And that is the time.
So it depends on
concentration inside.
My question is, what does the data actually look like? You said you would come back with
photos. Oui, oui. Well, a lot of early experiments by Sackman and so on gave something like a T1/2 law. And they tried to explain it by diffusion. But from the point of view of numbers, this T1/2 is not very far from the 5/8 which we quoted. But from a point of view of concept, it's interesting. Let me come back on this a little bit, because there is something there which is non-trivial. Here is this reaping balance, where I say that what I get inside is what I have reaped outside. Now, essentially, although we don't present it in this way, if I would assume that inside they have achieved a dense system with a fixed gamma I, and gamma I is a constant, and that would give me R squared equals the constant proportional to dt, so it would give me the square root law. But so it's tempting to think in these terms, but it's a cheat, because you cannot, I mean, you're not satisfied the equilibrium at the contact if you assume this, so you have to play with both. So diffusion, naive diffusion, is a little bit of a cheat.
You assume you have a cushion, yes?
Oui, for the heavy case.
Why is this actually? What do you think
you have? Well, the weight pushes this thing down, right, clearly. But it doesn't like to go really in molecular contact because of these fluctuation effects. If I put it too close, I am killing too many fluctuations, I'm losing too much entropy. So that, for that reason, I keep a cushion.
What about the Van der Waals?
There will be some Van der Waals, but it's not a huge thing because it's not Van der Waals between a half space, say, and a half space. It's Van der Waals between a layer and a half space. So it is one extra power. So it is a weak thing. And in the biological case, you kill the Van der Waals by having a brush. In the case which our people have, Pierre-Henri Puech and so on, what they do is they do also a brush with something like polyethylene oxide. They will have grafted polyethylene oxide, and then this thing likes water very much, and so it doesn't like to be squeezed. But you get protected in this way. So that's why you get a cushion in practice. Wait, there are, simple changes related to numbers and so on. That is not too bad. There are also, with the two cells, you are again in this case where you have a protective layer. So if you want them to be together, you need to put some squeezing force. If not, they will not do it. And there is still a very open question for me, which is many tests in pharmacology, you want to know if this cell adheres to this one, and you put them in suspension, for instance, and you watch at what rate they do go together, and then by pair counting, by little tricks, you can know how many. But this event is not simple, because they can come and rebound, and you want the patch to begin to build up before rebound, and that I don't know the story, that I don't really know.
You have a very nonlinear force. What do you think will be the effect on things like elastic properties of tissues or ruptures?
With rupture problems do occur. I'll tell you, the question is vast. I will give you just an answer in a microscopic sector of a question. There's one thing which I know. When you think of separating things which are related by glues in strong adhesive systems, that you put epoxy glues between two metal pieces or something like this, then the crux of a matter is in the separation energy, what I call G. And this G may be a function of the velocity at which you separate. But there is a G of V, and this is what commands the whole technology of adhesion. When you know this function, you know what your material does. So originally I thought maybe if I now have mobile stickers with diffusion, I can define a G of V. And lo and behold, I can't. Maybe I can show this on the board. Now, is there a way of disposing of this thing here? So you see, the situation would be something like this. You have some stickers here, some there, and you move this with a velocity V. More generally, you have a position here, which is a function of time. And you ask, what is the force opposing that motion? Now, in fact, you can solve that by looking at the diffusion equation in detail, but I don't need that. This force is essentially proportional. Remember a little sketch I had to the rigidity of the system. So it is something like derivative of osmotic pressure with respect to concentration times concentration. That's the rigidity. That has the dimensions of a force per unit length. And then there would be an integral over times, dt prime, before the time of measurement, t, of some response function of involving x of t prime. Now, I hope I can write it well. I would write it as dx t prime by dt prime. And then there must be some kernel here. And this kernel must be controlled by diffusion. And this thing has the dimensions of length. So this kernel cannot be anything else than square root of dt minus t prime. And this you can check by more precise calculation. But what this tells you was very surprising to me at first sight. Because if you would now put a constant velocity here, trying to get a GUV, a force which is function of velocity for a steady motion, constant velocity, this thing diverges a lot of times. So indeed, for these problems, you cannot define the usual GUV. Now you can if you have cutoffs. Of course, this is for an infinite medium. If this is limited here or limited there, there are cutoffs, and then I can return to that. But in principle, in the abstract form, I cannot define a GUV. So there is an enormous difference between these mobile systems and the systems which we meet in standard adhesion. And that is an amusing surprise.
In practice, how important are things like various dynamical objects like motors, say pumps, for example, pumping out the water out of the blisters and things like that? Are those important in practice or not?
They're
all covered by physics, you know, by this kind of quasi-equilibrium physics, or do you need these?
Well, we have one example which comes from this state, which is Robin Bruinsma, UCLA. Robin had a splendid idea to justify the notion that there might be phase transitions in this two-dimensional fluid of binders. And Robin's thing can be explained in a very simple way. I really love it. And I think it really has a meaning. This is a surface, and I'm bringing some binder here, and it will find a receptor there. But I have clothed with surface with a protective brush. Now, if I want to achieve this thing, I have to move the binder in, and I have to push the brush out. Here, I could try and sketch what the brush has become. Brush has become something like this, because I had to move it out. Now, this is what happens with the first. If I come with a second, I have a second side here, this one will benefit from the opening which the first has built. So it will be attracted to that region. So there's an attraction which is induced by the protective brush. Once you have an attraction, you have a phase transition, and you have these plateaus and osmotic pressure. So that seems to be pretty general. And in fact, we had worked with Eli Raphael many years ago about the questions of the scales of it. How far does this propagate and so on? And the rough answer is very stupid. It's just that the scale this way is about the height here, within coefficients and so on. So it's not a huge scale, but you do get some sort of local attraction between neighboring objects. And I think this is very important, because then you get these plateau things. And in fact, you would expect that when I talked about an adhesion patch, the naive view would be to have some sort of uniform density of my binders inside. But no, actually, because of the phase transition, I will have little islands in here, which has possibly been seen in some cases.
So it's not, the fact that it's not really a transition from liquid, but more to a droplet.
It would be, well, very much, indeed, you see this in some monolayer plateaus. You see that you have clumps of lipids, which is the little white things I drew here. And so you would have these clumps inside a large patch. The patch would be micron in size, and the clumps would be 10 times smaller, something like this.
Well, I think this is a good time to stop, so thank you.
Okay. Thank you.